The following audio is from Steadfast Church in Asheville, North Carolina. We exist to proclaim the good news of Jesus for the joy of all people to the ends of the earth. For more information about our church, our resources, or to support our ministry, please visit steadfastavl.org.
Amen. All right, let's give Ryan a steadfast welcome.
I'm so glad that's a steadfast welcome. There was so much fear of like, well, I don't know what's a steadfast welcome. Is it going to be crickets? They're going to throw things at me. So that was great. Man, steadfast, I'm so excited to be with y'all today. As Brian just mentioned, we're kicking off Holy Week, where we join with followers of Jesus around the world and throughout history in taking this week, the lead up to Easter, to slow down, to set our attention onto Jesus' final week leading up to his cross, his death, and then the declaration that on Easter Sunday, resurrection life has now broken through in the person and work of Jesus. And the strange, maybe, place to be doing all of that, looking towards Easter, is we're doing that from Exodus chapter 32, if you want to begin to start turning your way there. Which, like I said, Exodus 32 as the way to get ready for Easter seems strange, but I'm convinced that it's actually one of the best places to set our attention towards Easter. Some of you know the story of Jesus during his life and ministry goes up onto a mountaintop with some of his closest disciples, and there Jesus is transformed or transfigured. His radiant glory as the Son of God becomes visible to the disciples. And if that weren't crazy enough, Luke tells us, you'll see it right behind me, that there with Jesus in glory appears the Exodus guy, Moses, and the prophet Elijah, and they start talking together. And what they start talking about is all that he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. They start talking about Holy Week. But what's so fascinating is the way that they talk about it is they refer to it as Jesus' departure. But if you have a footnote in your Bible and you follow that down, it'll point out for you that in the Greek that Luke originally wrote, when they're talking about Holy Week, all that he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem, the word in the Greek that Luke wrote, the word on the lips of Moses and Jesus and Elijah is the Greek word Exodus. And so for Jesus, whatever he thinks is about to be done in Holy Week, whatever the cross is all about, the cleansing of the temple, his going toe-to-toe with the priesthood, his death, like I said, on the cross, his resurrection, all that he's about to accomplish in Jerusalem for Jesus is his Exodus. And so there's no better place for us to ask the question, how do we prepare for Easter weekend? Apparently for Jesus, it's by meditating on and contemplating the Exodus story and seeing how that speaks to the Easter story. And so today, as we're at Exodus 32, I want to do just that. I want to tease out how does the Exodus story fill in and set our attention towards the Easter story. And so as a little bit of background before we get into Exodus chapter 32, we are on the other side of the Prince of Egypt movie. This is the sequel, and it's not a good one. This is The Empire Strikes Back of the biblical story. We're on the other side of the Prince of Egypt. The plagues have been dealt with. Israel has been led out of slavery. The Red Sea parted, bread from heaven, water from rock, quails dropping all over the place. And God has brought his people to the base of Mount Sinai where he wants to covenant to marry them. I will be your God. You will be my people. You will become a kingdom of priests representing my glory, my blessing, and my goodness to the nations. And all of the people said, we do. In which case, after receiving this great news, Moses ascends Mount Sinai to basically work out the conditions of this whole arrangement. How will God dwell with his people? And so we get chapter after chapter leading up to Exodus 32 describing the tabernacle, the tent where God would dwell with his people and go with them. And in the midst of this whole conversation, while God is up on the mountain with Moses for these past 40 days, we arrive at Exodus 32. And we'll read a good chunk of it today, if not most of it. So follow with me and just watch how the story develops, and then we'll begin to unpack some of what's going on here, and again, how it points us to Exodus, or the new Exodus in Easter. So Exodus 32, beginning in verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, up! Make us gods who shall go before us.
As for this Moses fellow, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him. So Aaron said to them, take off your rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in the ears, and they brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord, a feast to Yahweh. And they rose up early the next day. They offered burnt offerings. They brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. The camera pans up the mountain. And the Lord said to Moses, go down to your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt. Your people, they have corrupted themselves. They've turned aside quickly from the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. We'll start over. But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out to kill them in the mountains and consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham? Remember Isaac and Israel, your servants, whom you swore by your very own self. You said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all this land I've promised, I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people. Skip down to verse 19 as Moses makes his way down the mountain back to the people. And as soon as Moses came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets. This is the final writing, that the Ten Commandments, out of his hands, and he broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf they had made and burned it with fire, ground it into a powder, scattered it on the water, and made the people of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you've brought such a great sin upon them? Aaron said, let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they're set on evil. For they said to us, they said to me, make us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So I said to them, let any of gold take it off. So they gave it to me. I threw it in the fire and out came this calf. And when Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose, to the derision, the shame of their enemies. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, who's on the Lord's side? Come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered around him, and he said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you. Go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor. The sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and on that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, today you've been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one of you, at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day. The next day, Moses said to the people, you've sinned a great sin. And now I'm going to go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people have sinned a great sin. They've made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you'll forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you've written. But the Lord said to Moses, whoever sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now, go, lead the people to the place about which I've spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made a calf, the one that Aaron made. This is the low point in Israel's story. this low point that is driven home by that final verse. The Lord sent a plague among the people of Israel. If you were to do Bible trivia just a few minutes ago before reading this passage, in the book, in the story of Exodus, what's the nation that receives the plagues? We'd all confidently say, oh, it's the enslaving empire of Egypt. And right here at this story, at the end of this story, the low point of Israel, we find the very people that God just delivered from slavery in Egypt now being treated like Egyptians, receiving one of the very plagues that he gave to Egypt. If you want a Bible nugget, a little nerd to geek out on, just to add to this dynamic, when Moses commissions the sons of Levi, telling them to go to and fro, bringing death on the guilty, that language of to and fro is used one other place in the Exodus story. It's the angel of death in the 10th command, the 10th plague. And so by all counts, here we are at the lowest point of Israel, and it's as though they themselves now stand in the position of Egypt, receiving plague and death on behalf, all over, we're told, this golden calf incident. Which, while maybe a big deal, seems to be kind of, you know, maybe an overreaction, you might think. So the kind of question before us as we move back through the passage today, as we see what's going on here, is what's going on with the golden calf incident? Why is this such a big deal? And then simultaneously, what does this mean for this new Exodus that Jesus is bringing? How does this set the table for Easter? So to do all that, back to the inciting incident in verse 1, where after 40 days of being up at the top of the mountain, the people go, they grow restless of waiting on Moses and by extension waiting on God. They're tired of waiting. They would prefer a God who works on their timetable, a God who works on their schedule, by all counts, can be controlled. They are tired of waiting. And so they call up Aaron. DoorDash us a deity. Amazon Prime us a God. We want a God that works on our expectations, our desires, and so make it happen. And so Aaron then pulls together the gold, which would have been the treasure that they got out of leaving Egypt that was meant just chapters before, God says, for the furniture and the accessories of the tabernacle where he would dwell, and they repurpose it. They drag it off and they use it for idolatry. Aaron uses the craftsmanship. It's so funny that it describes exactly what Aaron does, and then when he defends himself later, it just popped out. Like, no, man, there's a carving tool. You knew what you were doing. He builds and pulls this all together, and their impatience leads to idolatry. As he fashions this gold into the shape, the image of a golden calf, why not an aardvark or any other animal? After 430 years of slavery in Egypt, it's not surprising that the first thing that they go to is making a god that looks like a calf. For Egypt, their claimed creator god, Apis, was depicted as a golden bull. And so, of course, that's the image that they make. Of course, that's what they've been so thoroughly inundated and built around the way of worshiping like Egypt worships that that's the first thing that they reach for. But what's so surprising is not that they call the bull Apis in the story. They call the bull Yahweh. So they're not just breaking the first commandment, have no other gods. They're also breaking the second commandment at the same time. It's like two birds, one calf. We're making an idol of Yahweh and we're worshiping another god at the same time. It's as though Aaron puts together this Frankenstein monster of a god, bringing the work of God's deliverance from Egypt, the name of Yahweh, but putting it onto the characteristics and the nature of Apis. But they call it Yahweh. And so by all counts then, by the time we get to verse 6 and the christening of this new idol with this feast where they eat and drink and play, as our translators so politely put, what would have been drunkenness, gluttony, and just unhinged sexual expression. By the time we get to this, the overriding theme that we're finding here is that though Moses might have gotten Israel out of Egypt, for whatever reason, here we are, Egypt has not gotten out of Israel. Still bound to the idols and the worship of their culture. And now when it comes to idolatry, I know some of us might be prone that we kind of like shift our eyes towards like Haywood. And you think about the magic shops. You think about the coffee shop by my house that has like the poster of the goddess Artemis there. We go, oh yeah, those idols. But the driving function here is not simply as an idolatry being an issue out there or with those people, but a continual thing that happens for every single human being. David Foster Wallace, who wouldn't even have identified as a Christian, in his commencement speech for Kenyon College that he entitled "This Is Water," he relates to the fact that worship is the water that we swim in. You'll see the quote behind me here. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. Again, not a Christian saying this. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. And then he continues, though, that the insidious thing about these forms of worship is that they're unconscious. They are our default settings. To reread ourselves into Israel's story here, every single one of us have something that we reach for when we grow tired of waiting, either for God or for our lives to show up in the way that we want, in the timetables that we want. We go reaching for something. And so this is not just the Israelite problem. It's not even an Egyptian problem. It's a human problem. It's what David Foster Wallace identifies. And it's evident that the author of Exodus has the same opinion. As if you look through the primary verbs and dynamics of this story, you pay close attention to them, and you go back and read page 3 of the Bible, you'll find that one author says that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And that this story is a rhyming of the Genesis 3 story. Adam and Eve, who saw that the tree was good, they took, they gave, they ate. As a result, they were naked and ashamed. And on the other side of being challenged over what happened, they both blame shift.
The woman you gave me, that was the snake.
And when you reread through the primary verbs of this story here in Exodus 32, we open with the people seeing that Moses was delayed, Aaron taking the gold, giving the idol, and the people rising up and eating. And then later when Moses challenges him, in verse 25, Moses saw the people had broken loose to the derision of their enemies. The Hebrew language here is it's naked and shame. And what does Aaron do? Just like his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents and Adam and Eve, when he gets challenged over the sin, he blame shifts. It just popped out. And so the whole point of why I'm trying to bring this out here is that what's happening here is that idolatry may be still in the heart of Egypt, but before the Egyptians, before it was in the Israelites, it's the human story of idolatry. When God doesn't go the way that I want or the way that I expect, I reach out for something other than God. And the great tragedy is that in every single instance, it is always us reaching for something as a replacement for the very thing that God's preparing. What are the Israelites saying? What's the whole basis of it? Make us a God that goes before us. And if you just go read the chapters after chapters after chapters, what's God and Moses doing up at the top of the mountain? Building out the framework for how he's going to go, not just before them, but with them. And so in the replacement, they trade the great thing that God has for them for something much worse. And so this is the ongoing problem with all humans. And here being Palm Sunday, it's not just an Israel back then story. As Jesus makes his triumphal entry, the hosannas and the palm branches and the praises, one thing that we always skirt over in the story is Jesus is weeping as he comes through. And the reason that we're told is because Jesus sees into the heart of those worshiping, and what he finds is they have made him into a golden calf. And they made him into an idol, but not that in the shape of a golden calf. They've fused his status and role with Messiah as a warring conqueror who has come to take victory over their political and national enemies, to get the boot of Rome off their neck. And so Jesus is weeping because he sees that just like Israel with a golden calf, they've made an idol, an image of him. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, because at verse 7, when we go up the mountain, we begin to watch the dialogue between God and Moses. We find God detail for Moses in his words, not just the pattern of idolatry that's developed, but now the fallout, where idolatry leads. And in verse 7, it begins with an alienation from God. As all throughout the book of Exodus, he has constantly referred to Israel as my people whom I will rescue. I am your God. You are my people. And right here, like an exasperated parent to another, your people who you, Moses, brought up. One commentator went as far to say, this is Yahweh disowning his people. Stepping back and going, I no longer identify with them. It's an alienation and a distance from God. But all over a golden calf. Why? As verse 7 continues, he says they've corrupted themselves. Now, I don't normally like to pick at like English translations of the Bible because I know it's really hard work. But this is one where corrupted, at least to me, sounds like God's like, they got themselves dirty. Like they've made a mess of things. But the Hebrew word here for corruption is the language of destruction, of annihilation, of ruin. God's issue with idolatry is not just that it's some kind of religious rebellion, but they've given themselves over to self-destruction. They've destroyed themselves. They've ruined themselves. All of this is they've given themselves over to something that's lingering or at work within the metal, that it's not the idol itself. But as Moses later says in Deuteronomy, when he recounts this moment, he says that what they gave themselves to worship was not to gods, but to demons. That there is a corrupting influence that as humans give themselves over to idols, to something other than God, there's an influence that begins to be at work that corrupts, that destroys, that pulls the human apart at the string. And so David Foster Wallace, again, not even as a Christian, identifies this playing out with the idols in our time. You'll see it behind me. He says, if you worship money and things, if there were you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. Never feel that you have enough. It's the truth. If you worship your body and beauty, sexual allure, you'll always feel ugly. And when you time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, you'll end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you'll end up always feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Notice just the corrupting effect that the very thing that the idols offer, they end up warring against us ever actually having. They've corrupted themselves. And as they corrupt us, God identifies in verse 9 that it has a deforming effect on the human soul. See, humans were made in God's image. Israel was called to be bearers of his image, carriers of his name, royal representatives who, like N.T. Wright would refer to it as an angled mirror, who humans are meant to reflect the glory and the goodness, the character and works of God out into the world, and then the praise and the thanks and the gratitude of the world back up to God. This mediator between heaven and earth, this is what humans were meant to be, to image and reflect the glory of God. And yet, as the mirror gets pointed in the wrong direction, the human ends up resembling the thing that it worships. And so after worshiping a golden calf, God says, I've seen this people. Behold, take a look. They're stiff-necked. This is farmer talk. This is the language of livestock that is unwilling to be tamed, to be yoked, to be led or guided. They are stiff-necked, obstinate, and stubborn. They've become like what they worship. And so the human vocation of bearing God's image has been traded out for acting and living like animals, slaves to their appetites and desires, like we see in the way that they worship the calf, eating, drinking, and playing. And so all of this then comes together in God's final declaration, the condemnation over this all. That is not, again, simply him going, oh, look at that, they broke some rules. That's why I'm mad. But what does he say? Therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them. I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. This is not the distant wrath of a cold judge. This is the passionate fury of a husband that has been betrayed, not even on his honeymoon, but on the wedding night. And if you think that's harsh, that's not me. That's the prophets of the Old Testament time and again. When they reflect on this moment, they refer to idolatry, this moment, as spiritual adultery. That though God had wooed them and brought them, saved them, provided for them, done all that he could to care for them, bringing them to Mount Sinai, covenanting himself to them, they haven't even left the reception. It's like they signed the marriage contract and Moses went up the hill to find the groom so he would sign his part of it. And while he goes looking for her, the bride runs off with someone else. And so God, as a groom who has a passionate love for the one that he's called out and chosen, is now just, I'm done. I'm going to walk away from it all. And so the destruction and the wrath of consuming them is simply him going, I'm giving them over to the destructive lover they've chosen. But in the midst of the condemnation, and again, the alienation, the corruption, the deformation, God always leaves this door of invitation open for his mercy. In that phrase, at the beginning of verse 10, let me alone. This is not a command. This is an invitation to Moses. If you leave me alone, I'll start over with you. But it leaves the door open. What happens if Moses doesn't? And so even right here, before we get into Moses' work, what we find is the recurring problem is that Israel has gotten out of Egypt, but Egypt has not gotten out of them. Idolatry is the true enslaving power that must be dealt with. It is the thing that even if God brings his people out of the destructive powers of the world, there are still destructive powers at work within the human heart. That must somehow be dealt with. And so all this then sets up, I said it's Israel's low point, but it's actually Moses' highest. This is like Moses' gleaming moment of glory, because he does and shows up in all the ways that Israel's failed to do. He's the angled mirror, the mediator between heaven and earth, who stands representing an idolatrous and broken people, but also feet firmly founded in the character and the goodness of God. I mean, this is Moses at his flying colors best. And so what does he do in verse 11? He moves right into intercession on behalf of the people who are currently worshiping an idol. Moses implored his God. And what does he first do? He flips it on him. God said, your people that you led, he pins the people on Moses. He goes, no, this was your idea. Your people whom you led, they are yours regardless of the idolatry. You claim them for yourself. He then leans in so heavily, not to claiming God stay his hand from this destruction on the basis of him as a mediator, or I know they're kind of messy right now, but if you see past all that, he grounds his intercession in the character and the works of God. He appeals to your power. Think about what you did to bring them out of Israel. Don't let that, or bring them out of Egypt. Don't let that go for naught. Think about what the Egyptians would, think about what the neighbors would think. These Egyptians that, they would just see you as another capricious god, just like all the gods of Egypt who would lead people out to the wilderness, break free just to kill them. You're not one of those gods. And then he appeals to the promises that he's made to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Remember your promises. In all of these, Moses as an intercessor is not asking God to be anything other than who he's revealed himself to be. Charles Spurgeon puts it this way, that prayer is mostly just looking at God and saying, do as thou hast said. You said you're faithful, be faithful. You said you're gracious, be gracious. He calls on him to do it all. And verse 14, if all of this isn't crazy enough, verse 14, the Lord relented from the disaster, changed his mind, changed his plan, as it can be translated. And there's been no stop of ink in figuring out how the dynamics of prayer and the will of God work. And the great gift of being a guest preacher, as I can say, all of your questions, Brian would love to answer. What does it mean the Lord relented, Brian? But in the midst of the discussion, in the midst of the what does this mean, how does this play out, the thing that every scholar agrees on is the necessity of a mediator and the genuine power of prayer at work within the world. As St. Augustine put it, without God we cannot, but without us God will not. There's something at the heart of God that he's looking for a partnership, a conversation, a movement outward. As Michael Morales puts it in his book on all of this, he says, apart from Moses' intercessory prayers, Israel would have surely been destroyed. He uses his unique status before God to strive with him on behalf of, I love this, an unthankful rabble. Moses embodies, here it is, the vocation of the mediator, one who stands between the holy and the profane. And so God stays his hand, and then as we move into the back half of Moses' work here, he moves from the angled mirror again, reflecting Israel to God, and now as he comes down the mountain, he begins to reflect God back out to the people. And so this intercession for mercy now turns into him carrying the anger of God over what's just happened, but all the while, it's severe, but it's mercy. He's trying to preserve the people. Because remember, whatever comes after this, and I know there's the 3,000 people, there's people drinking like gold water, like what's going on here? Whatever happens in the following is a severe mercy because it's the alternative to God consuming them. So what Moses does is steps into the incredible mediator role. And so in his intercession, it's as though Jesus retraces his steps in his Holy Week. We might better say Moses pre-traces Jesus' steps. Because just like Moses does this great work of intercession here, Jesus in John chapter 17, hours before the cross, he intercedes on behalf of his people. Not just his disciples, but for you and me. What Moses did for Israel in this moment, Jesus does for not just his disciples, but as he puts it, all who would believe through their witness. You and me. And so Jesus intercedes, and then just like Moses, he moves out into the world to deal with the issues of Israel. And so in verse 19, Moses comes down and he throws down the tablets. He tears up the marriage contract. He gives a visible sign of what their idolatry has done. And in the same way, Jesus, right after Palm Sunday, he goes straight to the temple and he cleanses the temple, turning over tables, casting everyone out. A visible sign of ruining the temple that just reflects the fact that they've already ruined it by their greed and their exclusion of the nations. And then we find, man, this is the big one. So Bible nerd hat on for a second, because it's just weird. What happens next? Is Moses crushes the idol, burns it down, crushes it, which you're like, all right, cool. And then Moses goes for like overkill, apparently. He throws it on water. He's like, everybody drink it. Like, it's like, what is going on with Moses here? So this is where, the Bible nerd pointing to one thing and then hopefully trying to move quickly through. Remember that what idolatry is seen as in the story is spiritual adultery. Later, as the story develops, we find this kind of Numbers chapter 5, this ordeal that surrounds a woman or spouse that's suspected of adultery, where she would drink this kind of bitter mixture that if she nothing happened, then she's fine. Then it's like, yeah, okay, the husband, you're weird. Like, chill out, bud. But if it was genuine, she would get sick and it would be a sign of her guilt and then they would move from there. I know it's weird. And you're like, well, what about just, I don't know. The whole point, though, here is just to highlight the fact that what's going on is Moses is taking all of Israel through basically the test and the judgment regarding adultery. Why? Because that's precisely what's happened. And so in the same way that in that test that being guilty would show itself through some form of sickness, most ancient scholars, this again, I told you, Bible, the plague that comes out in verse 35, many scholars link that to the drinking of the bitter water. And then similarly, the 3,000 that the sons of Levi go after are able to identify. It's not an indiscriminate massacre, as one scholar puts it. It's a surgical removal of those most guilty of the idolatry. And the way they were identified was by the plague. Does that make sense? Like, what might be going on here? And again, it's Bible. And now we're moving on. Because the whole point, though, is again the question, just to leave this up in the air, is okay, Moses, I see you're dealing with idolatry, you've got crazy ways of doing it. How does Jesus fulfill this in the new Exodus? He's like replaying and reversing all these different aspects. Where does this one go? Put a pin in that. In verse 21 through 24, Moses confronts Aaron, the priesthood, calling him out for the fact that he's led the people in idolatry. How does Jesus spend most of his final week before the cross on the other side of cleansing the temple? Challenging and correcting and calling out the priests. The 25 woes that Jesus, or the Matthew 25 and the woes that Jesus gives to the priesthood, it's a replay of this very same story. Calling out the religious leaders who were meant to fight for the holiness of God's name, who gave themselves over to playing. And then finally, we have the calling of the Levites, where Moses stands and said, who's on the Lord's side? Come to me. The sons of Levi, come to him. Swords drawn, and they move through the camp, cutting out all of the most guilty. Again, it's like a surgical incision of cutting off the infected body part to save the rest. And whatever we want to do with that, there's a lot that can be spent there. What's interesting to me, at least, is if you've ever read the Garden of Gethsemane story, where the guards come to arrest Jesus, and what does Peter do? Swinging the sword, he just starts going at right. You ever wonder why is Peter why do you have a sword? What's going on here, right? And then Jesus puts it away. I think genuinely what's happening is Peter, who witnessed the conversation at the Mount of Transfiguration about the new Exodus that's coming, and he's been watching Jesus replay and repeat step after step of the new Exodus, at the Garden of Gethsemane, he's like, this is the Sons of Levi moment. This is the moment, the zealous remnant who rises up for the holiness of God, and they start swinging their swords in order to defend that. So Peter does it, but then the surprise is that Jesus goes, that's actually not the way this Exodus works, bud. A for effort, but that's not how this works. And so it's interesting that it seems like Peter understands this to be what's happening. And so what's fascinating, to jump on the other side of Easter to Pentecost, is Peter on the other side of putting down the sword and being given the Spirit gives the first sermon of Pentecost. And what happens is in that moment, him trading the sword and taking up the Spirit and preaching the word leads not to 3,000 being judged, but 3,000 being saved. It's like Pentecost is not only a reversal of, people have talked about the Tower of Babel, it's also a reversal of the golden calf incident, where this new Exodus is turning everything inside out. Now, so through all of this, what Moses has been doing is carrying a severe mercy, but fighting for the prolonged continuation of the people of God, that God would be able to go with his people by cutting out that idolatry, to try to get Egypt out of Israel. But in verse 30, we find that he seems to think it hasn't been enough. The next day, Moses said to the people, you've sinned a great sin. Now I'm going to go up for the Lord. What's the missing piece that for all of this we haven't been able to do yet? Perhaps I can make atonement for you. So Moses walked back up the mountain, and he spoke to Yahweh saying, these people have sinned a great sin. I've seen what they've done. I've done my best to cut off the fruit of idolatry and sin, but as he later says in Deuteronomy, I know what's in their hearts. But now if you will forgive their sin, but if not, he says, blot me out of the book that you've written. What's fascinating is Moses reverses the very offer that God made to him back on the mountain. God on the mountain said, I'm going to consume them and I'll start over with you. And it's almost as if Moses being so in tap with image of God stuff, being in his presence, that he can't help step into self-giving, self-offering, sacrificial love that would be willing to allow himself to be the, not consume, he says, consume me so that they might be who you start over with. But the thing that I can't move past is what's so fascinating is in this moment, this is Moses' highlight reel. He's got, his foibles coming up. Don't worry. But God doesn't bring that up. He doesn't go, you can't do it because you're imperfect. I need a blameless representative. He just goes, judgment along with forgiveness is my prerogative, Moses. I will judge who I judge. I will not leave the guilty unpunished. And it just kind of ends there, hanging over the story. Now, if we were to move into chapters 33 and 34, we'd find God, again, re-knitting this covenant community, promising to go with them, him declaring his name as being the Lord, gracious, steadfast, abounding in steadfast love, and he forgives iniquity and sin and transgression. He's the God who forgives to the nth generation, and yet he's also the one who will not leave the guilty unpunished. How will we have Yahweh be the God who both forgives iniquity and sin, but somehow also doesn't leave the guilty unpunished? This is the question that hangs over the sacrificial system, over the Day of Atonement in the Old Testament, and it comes to a point in the prophet Isaiah, who as he begins to look forward and he sees the idolatry in his generation, what he says is, what he says in his generation is, I see the idolatry and we're right back to the golden calf. We're right back to the fact that the people just can't seem, so prone to wander are they. And so he looks forward and he starts talking about this new Exodus. But the way that he refers to this new Exodus is the language right here from Exodus 32 is the forgiveness of sins. For him, that's the new Exodus. And the way that he talks about it coming about would be someone who would do what Moses offered to, but for some, whatever reason, God just said, no, it's not for him to do. He talked about him, Isaiah, the prophet, as being like Moses, a servant of the Lord, and yet also simultaneously being the arm of the Lord, an extension, or we might even say an incarnation of God's own self, who would come to deal with not just the forgiveness of sins, but to deal with idolatry at the heart of it. He writes in Isaiah 53, you'll see behind me, this servant of the Lord who is the arm of the Lord, he was pierced because of our rebellion, crushed because of our iniquities, and punishment for our peace was on him, and we are healed by his wounds. Isaiah is picking up and playing with the language of the crushed idol. He's picking up and playing with the language of the sons of Levi swinging their swords, all to say, where does the idol get crushed in the new Exodus? It gets crushed somehow in the servant himself being crushed. Where goes the plague that comes out from that? It somehow gets taken by the servant himself. And so this hangs over all of the story of the Old Testament. And so I can't help but think that at the Transfiguration, when Moses is right there talking to Jesus about his Exodus, everything that he would be accomplished, the amount of joy that Moses experienced in finding, oh, this is the reason why God said no. This is the one who truly was able to do what I simply was able to offer and in a weird way echo the thing that he would actually provide. Whereas I was able to stay God's hand with his wrath through intercession and calling on God for who he is, this Jesus has come not simply just to stave off wrath, but to reunite the relationship of God with his people, to rebuild the relationship that's been broken, to take the trajectory that leads to corruption and destruction and to set people onto a new trajectory that leads to greater life, to restart the image of God vocation within humanity. By himself being the perfect mediator and image of God who was able to reject idolatry during his 40 days in the wilderness, and now through his resurrection life given to his people, set them out into the world mediating God's presence himself. So instead of the idol being crushed, it is Jesus that is crushed. Instead of the bitter drink being given to the people, it is Jesus who takes the cup of God's wrath. Instead of the sons of Levi cleansing the community by killing off the guilty, it is Jesus who stands in their place and allows the destruction that comes on him to be what cleanses his community. And then, just like the idol was crushed and was given as a drink, Jesus is crushed and gives himself in the bread and the cup, saying, remember, receive from me, receive the life, not just me, God holding off on his wrath, but giving you a new life. Giving you a new start to step back into this image of God vocation. This is what I have for you. So as we turn towards the table into Holy Week, just three ways of considering how we might carry this out. The first is the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when he reflects on this very story, the example that's set before us, he says, is simply to flee idolatry. Run from it. For freedom, you've been set free. Do not again submit yourselves to a yoke of slavery, is the way that he puts it. And so in the same way, it's worth spending time today before we come to the table, but this week, what are the patterns of idolatry that emerge within my heart? And if you struggle to find them, just consider the questions of where, like the Israelites, do I grow impatient with God when he doesn't work on my timetables? Where, like the Israelites, does my treasure go? Where, like Aaron, do I give my skills and my craftsmanship to? And what, like eating, drinking, and playing, do I give my body to? And even just more simply, when I come into prayer, where do I feel alienation from God as if he's putting his finger on something? And like Paul says, you bring it to Jesus and flee. There's a genuine corrupting influence, and Jesus is here to save you out of that. Second is to intercede. Because the intercession of Jesus doesn't just save us, it shapes us into mediators and intercessors ourselves. As we've been going through this season at Steadfast, you know, the regular thing has been, who's one person that you can be reaching out to and ministering to? I would encourage you to almost read through Moses' prayer over Israel, over that person this week. To call down God's praise, his reputation, and his promises, his character, over that individual's life. And then finally, Moses stands before the crowd and says, come to me. And in the same way, Jesus offers those same words. He says, come to me. You'll see behind me. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. He says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. Jesus, like Moses, offers an idolatrous, broken people to come to him to receive the healing work that only he can do. And what's so fascinating to me is, if you've ever read the passage before, why does Jesus talk about coming to him as being like a yoke or a burden that somehow brings healing? It seems, at least to me, that Jesus is picking up the image of what happens under idolatry. We become stiff-necked. And it's almost as though he's saying, hey, come from me and I'm going to fix that stiff neck. I'm going to fix that stubbornness and that reliance, that addiction to slavery, this slavery to idolatry. But the way that I'm going to do it is through my gentleness. It's through being humble and lowly in heart. So just walk with me, come to me, and allow me to heal over time all the effects, all the impacts, to get Egypt out of you, as you might say. So we're going to come to communion. We're going to take just a moment, and I'm going to pray for us. We'll enter into just a time of kind of reflection before we do so. And then within a few minutes, as you feel led, feel free to come forward to take from the cup, to take from the bread, as we remember Jesus as the one who is the true image of God, who was crushed so that he might give us not a bitter drink, but the drink of life. Amen? So, Father, you are the God who is so committed to us that you will not even allow our own self-destructive ways to get in the way of your promises. And so as we move into Holy Week, as we move into remembering the work that Jesus, you have done on our behalf, we just take this time right now to just say, is there any way that new exodus that you've brought out, that you're still wanting to do that work within us? Are there any lingering parts of idolatry, of Egypt, as we've been saying, that you still want to lead out of us? And so we just open ourselves to you today, and we just ask, Jesus, would you continue the work that you accomplished on Good Friday? Would you continue the victory that you secured on Easter? Would you continue that work within each of us today? Amen.